Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Because of the opinions held by those who attack me, I am obliged to speak out to the people, lest my silence make me a criminal. I have offended no one in high office. What I have done is not dishonourable. Those who defame me do so because they are unable to persecute me legally. This is my vindication, since everyone knows how I have been insulted, slandered, vilified. I confess that I am not tolerant, but my serenity rests on the knowledge of the rightness of the cause of His Excellency, the Liberator. I shall never, never regress a single step in that respect from the friendship and gratitude I hold towards General Bolivar. And if anyone believes that to be a crime, it demonstrates the poverty of his soul. Manuela Sainz, writing in an editorial entitled To the People, 20th of June, 1830. Hello, and welcome to The Other Half. Episode 5.17, Manuela Sainz, The Liberator of the Liberator. In our last episode, we explored South America during its wars of independence and met Manuela Sainz, a passionate revolutionary. Born in Ecuador, thanks to an extramarital affair, Manuela married a dull English merchant and moved to Peru, where she began her political and revolutionary career. After contributing to the liberation of Lima, she returned to Ecuador and met the love of her life, Simón Bolívar, the Liberator. Their love was a real force we reckoned with, leading to Sainz becoming Bolívar's partner on the campaign trail and in the political arena. With the Spanish finally expelled from the continent, Bolívar faced the daunting task of building a new state. However, this proved far more challenging than his military victories, as his vision of a federal South America with a few powerful states at the helm conflicted with the realities of vested interests and the rising tide of nationalism. Furthermore, there was a growing distrust of his authoritarian tendencies. When we left the action, Manuela had just been expelled from Peru, a nation that had just severed its ties with Bolívar, declared its independence, and now she was on a boat back to Ecuador. Today, Manuela returns to Bolívar's side as he struggles to hold his dream together, his health declines, and the question of his succession looms. Before we proceed with the story, I'd like to thank all of my fantastic Patreon supporters. Your support is essential in keeping this show running, and I am sincerely thankful to each and every one of you. If you would like to support the show, then you can visit patreon.com/theotherhalfpodcast, where you can become a patron for as little as $1 a month. Additionally, you can follow the show on Facebook and Twitter, where we post bonus content from this episode, including pictures and maps, to enhance your listening experience. To all my new listeners, welcome. To the rest of you, welcome back. Manuela Sainz had been born in the wake of a devastating earthquake. And as she prepared to return to Bolivar in December 1827, another huge tremor struck. In Bogota, the capital of Gran Colombia, a number of buildings and churches were severely damaged. Although nothing like as damaging as the 1797 quake, this was not a great omen for Sainz and Bolivar. As she travelled north, she was able to take the temperature of the various civic leaders in the towns and villages she passed through. What she heard deeply concerned her. Simón Bolívar's revolution had swept away the Spanish monarchy, but he was not a natural republican. Though he took some inspiration from the newly formed United States to the north when it came to his federalism, he was actually a bigger fan of the British model of government. This had an elected lower house of parliament with limited suffrage, a hereditary upper house, and a head of state with limited powers who ruled for life. He thought that this system was the best one for guaranteeing both stability and liberty for Gran Colombia. Of course, the United Kingdom was ruled by a constitutional monarchy, and at least at this point, Bolívar was not about to declare himself king, but he was the closest thing to it, president for life. But there was the problem of the messy business of elections, which he saw as inherently dangerous. He described them as being a mechanism for, quote, anarchy, the handmaiden of tyranny, and the most imminent and terrible peril of popular government. But Bolívar's vision alarmed liberals and republicans in Gran Colombia, who feared that Bolívar was acting like Julius Caesar. He may have been an honourable man and be telling the truth about not wanting to be king, but who knew of the would-be Octavians that may follow him? To them, Bolívar threatened their liberty and the long-term survival of their country, so they sought ways to curtail his power. As you may have noticed, that is a relatively high-level view of what is going on. And that's because I want to avoid going too deep into the cesspool of Gran Colombian politics around this time. It's a whole lot of names and complexity that would unnecessarily elongate this episode. If you want to learn more, then Season 5 of Mike Duncan's Revolution podcast is the place to go. But there is one figure that we need to introduce, and that is his vice president, Francisco Santander. He had been Bolívar's partner in the Wars of Independence, but his skills lay far more in politics than war. He was known as the Man of Laws. So while Bolívar went off with the army to fight the Spanish, Santander got on with the grubby business of state building and financing Bolívar's wars. The two had once been like brothers, but had now become bitter rivals. Santander was not interested in Bolívar's dreams. He was a proud Colombian, and was not interested in spending his country's resources financing Bolívar's grand internationalist ambitions in places like Peru, Venezuela, and Bolivia. Indeed, he regarded Bustamante, the officer who had led the mutiny that had led to Manuela Sainz being kicked out of Peru, as a hero, and arranged for him to be promoted to the rank of colonel. Things came to a head at the Ocaña Constitutional Convention, during which Bolívar and Santander supporters argued and manoeuvred to determine Colombia's future, and how its government would be structured. However, this was not an even fight. Most of Bolivar's supporters were well-to-do landowners, clergy, and military men. Powerful backers, but nothing like as wily and canny political operators as Santander's. Seeing the tide was against them, Bolivar's supporters abandoned the convention and instead encouraged the Liberator to cross another Rubicon, declare an emergency, and assume full dictatorial powers, which he did in June 1828. Unsurprisingly, Sainz took Bolivar's side. Writing to her lover after defeat of an uprising led by one of Santander's supporters, quote, "Santander has done it again, as if what he has done was not enough to warrant our shooting him." In another missive, she described him and his supporters as, quote, "wicked men, God grant they die." With Bolivar's list of friends and supporters dwindling, Sainz rose to become not only his lover and confidant, but also one of his closest advisers. This brought her right into the heart of his inner circle, allowing her to get to know all of the key people surrounding him. She kept her eyes open constantly and her ears close to the ground. Every day she would send her servants into the market to hear what ordinary people were saying, while by night she hosted her tertulias, basically a fashionable salon, where she would expertly work the room. To many, she was a figure of chaos and mischief. But to those who were paying attention, they saw that this was mostly a facade. She was an expert political agent, hiding in plain sight. She was also working on her public profile. While she had been a significant figure in Lima, she was not as well known in Bogota. She sought to change this with a party that she threw to celebrate Simón Bolívar's birthday. This was open to all and sundry, and featured free food and drink, live entertainment, and a military parade. If there's a way to the general public's hearts, it is generally through free stuff. There was also a more exclusive private bash after the public party, with only Bolívar's closest allies invited. Bolívar unfortunately couldn't attend this private bash, but that didn't seem to stop the revelry. Now, I'm not sure what happens at the parties you go to, but this was unlike any that I have ever attended, as it involved the trial and execution of a dummy. After having had a few too many champagnes, some of the guests fashioned an effigy of Santander out of a sack of grain, several black silk stockings, and a tricorn hat. After a hasty, quote-unquote, treason trial, the dummy was propped on a bench near the entrance, and a priest performed the, quote-unquote, last rites, before a firing squad was assembled. After the dummy was blasted by a volley of musket fire from the Grenadier Guards, the priest then performed a sermon above the punctured sack. I mean, Santander. When news of this got out, it caused quite the scandal. They may be political opponents, but Santander was still the vice president, and involving army officers in what appeared to many to be the prelude and rehearsal for a military coup caused outrage. Most of the heat fell on Manuela Sainz, who was cast as the ringleader and instigator of this incident. For what it's worth, she denied any involvement. In a letter to Bolivar, she claimed that she had been indoors while all of this was going on, attending to some unspecified chore. She professed shock and embarrassment at what had transpired, saying that it was keeping her from sleeping. Given Sainz's mischievous nature, love of pranks, and hatred of Santander, I don't find her protestations all that convincing. This incident further convinced Bolivar's opponents that they had to act. If he was determined to be South America's Julius Caesar, he should meet the same fate. Thanks to her network of contacts, Sainz heard rumblings of the plot before Bolivar and warned her lover that his life was in real peril. She implored him to take more care, to only travel under armed escort, but Bolivar didn't listen. She encouraged him to beef up his personal security to protect his residence, but Bolivar didn't listen. She urged him to crack down on dissenters and give law enforcement powers to ferret out those who wished him ill. But Bolivar did not listen. He wasn't a fool. He knew he had opponents. But he was still the liberator. The army supported him. Nothing, surely, could touch him. The first attempt on his life came at a masked ball on the 10th of August 1828, held to celebrate the anniversary of one of Bolivar's great military victories. Science had heard from the grapevine that some of the guests have concocted a plan to seize the liberator at the ball and stab him with daggers hidden from under their cloaks. Et tu, Brute, indeed. Their plan was simple. When the clock struck 12, the liberator would die. Science begged Bolivar not to come, but he refused to listen. There was no threat here, and even if there were, it would be rank cowardice not to come and celebrate his great victory. Unable to sway him, she took matters into her own hands. So when she arrived at the party ahead of Bolivar, she came provocatively, dressed in male military attire. This caused quite a stir, drawing the attention of the mayor of Bogota. Manuela was only just getting started. As Bolivar arrived at the ball, she started a very loud and very public row with the mayor. He told her that she could not be there in men's clothes. She said that she was Manuela Sainz. Didn't he know who she was? He replied that it didn't matter if she was Saint Manuela. No woman could be at this party dressed as a man, acting intentionally like an entitled cow. She was trying to cause such a scene that Bolivar would have to leave out of sheer embarrassment. And it worked. Disgusted at his mistress's behaviour, his face burning red with shame, he turned on his heels and left, leaving his would-be assassins cursing Manuela under their breath. Science had saved Bolivar's life, at a significant cost both to her reputation and to her relationship with him. He refused to speak to her after the event, seeing her behaviour as utterly inexcusable. Not believing that his life had ever been in danger, he forbade Science from visiting him. Deeply hurt, Science wrote to him, quote, "I know you are vexed with me, but it is not my fault. With the pain of this displeasure upon me, I can scarcely sleep. However, this much remains certain. I will not come to your house until you ask for me or want to see me." The failure of this first assassination attempt did not deter the plotters. Indeed, it merely emboldened them to an even greater and grander conspiracy. These were young idealists, composed mainly of lawyers, teachers, and students, backed by some military men who would be integral to their plans to seize control post-assassination. They planned to launch their coup in late October. But on the 25th of September, one of their number, an army officer called Captain Triana, got spectacularly drunk one night and drew his sword against a Bolivarian loyalist, declaring that the tyrant must die. This forced the conspirators to accelerate their plans and attack that very night. This time, it was Bolivar who had heard about the plot before Sainz from an informant. But he did not believe a word of it. He refused to take any steps, either against the plotters or to increase his own security. Indeed, that night he went to bed with only a sword and a pistol by his bed and a couple of guards on duty. Sainz was also with him. He had forgiven her finally for her outburst at the ball and had asked to come around to nurse him through a head cold. They were staying in the grandiosely named Palace of San Carlos, which Bolivar's nephew described thusly to a friend. Quote, "It is a house, two stories high, built with good taste and luxuriously furnished. The principal patio is enclosed with an iron railing. The arrangement on the second floor is different in that it only has a corridor which leads to the dining room and the interior room occupied by my uncle. On the street side there are five rooms of varying size, the first one being where the Council of Ministers meet. The last one, a luxuriously papered room, serves as a bedroom. Here, there is a superbly fashioned matrimonial bed. It was in this bed that Bolivar fell asleep, with Sainz in the next room. It was still dark outside when she was awoken to the sound of Bolivar's barking dogs, several soft thumps, and loud, angry voices downstairs exclaiming, "Death to Bolivar!" and "Long live liberty!" The paltry number of guards charged with defending Bolivar's home were no match for the more than 30 invaders and were already dead. Their final moments were the thumps that Sainz had heard. There was no one standing between the would-be assassins and their target. She rushed next door and woke Bolivar, who made to grab his weapons and attack the invaders. But Sainz persuaded him that he couldn't face the enemy in just his nightshirt. He had to get some clothes on. While he dressed, she barricaded the door, buying them some time. When he'd done so, he picked up a pistol and his sword, turned to her and said, quote, "Now what? Shall we brave the storm?" But Sainz knew that even Bolivar could not take on all those men single-handed. He had to get out. With the enemy bearing down on the door, the only other egress was the window, which opened out onto the street, and it was an easy jump to the cobbles below. She persuaded him that discretion was the better part of valour. So, as the door began to splinter with the force of the blows, Bolivar made his escape. Once he had jumped out the window, she calmly went to the door and opened it. One of the intruders later recalled, quote, "There appeared in the doorway a strikingly beautiful woman, sword in hand, who, with admirable presence of mind and very courteously, asked us what we wanted. They demanded to know where Bolivar was. Sainz said that she didn't know, but he wasn't there. They could see for themselves." While they searched the room, she assessed the scene. They were armed with daggers and pistols and clearly meant business. But they were also frustrated. They must be under some time pressure. She realised that the clock was now her best friend and only chance of survival. Not finding their quarry, the conspirators roughly seized Manuela and demanded to know where Bolivar was. She said that she thought he might be in the council room. She then proceeded to lead them on a wild goose chase. She pretended to get lost finding the council room. And when they finally got there and found it empty, she then took them through every other room in the house in the most inefficient manner possible. Finally losing their patience, the attackers rounded on Sainz and began to attack her with the hilts of their swords, looking to beat Bolivar's whereabouts out of her. Abandoning all pretense, she said with glee, quote, "He's safe. I helped him flee." She was kicked, punched. One of them even slashed at her with his blade, cutting her across the ear. She was hit so many times in the head that even years later, you could still see the imprint on her forehead. But she remained defiant. Blood dripping down her face, she screamed at them, quote, "Go on! Kill me! Kill me, you miserable cowards!" They were sorely tempted, but their leader said that they were not there to murder women. So she was locked in a room, while the conspirators debated what to do next. Sainz's delaying tactics had worked so well that the sun was rising by now, and Bogota was discovering what had transpired that night. Realising that the jig was up, the attackers fled, allowing Sainz to escape and find Bolivar, who had spent a long and terrifying night hiding under a bridge. Greeting her with tears in his eyes and in front of all of his men, Bolivar declared her La Libertadora del Libertador, the Liberator of the Liberator. After the attempt on his life, Bolivar would never be the same again. His faith in his people had been shattered. He saw himself as a beacon of liberty, and yet, had it not been for the quick thinking of his mistress, he would have been murdered as a tyrant. In its wake, he passed a number of laws restricting freedoms and clamping down on dissent. A special tribunal was set up, and around 50 people were summarily tried and convicted of being involved in the plot. Of these, 14 were sentenced to death by firing squad, though 9 of them would have their sentences commuted, including Francisco Santander. Bolívar knew who he had to thank for surviving the assassination attempt that has become known to history as the Septembrian Conspiracy. Not only did he give his beloved a killer new moniker, but he integrated her even more tightly into his administration. If there is one advantage to surviving an assassination attempt, it is that it tends to clarify who you can trust and who can be relied upon to have your back when the chips are down. Manuela Sainz had not only demonstrated her loyalty and devotion, she had proven herself to be one of Bolívar's most capable allies. So even as she recovered from the injury she sustained in the attack, she was interrogating suspects from her sickbed. Now, you might have expected her to preach vengeance and death to the traitors, but actually, she did quite the opposite. When 2 of the men that had attacked her were brought before her for identification, she denied ever having seen them in the palace, despite her maid testifying to the contrary. She claimed to have done so out of sympathy for their relatives, who had come to her pleading leniency. She also sheltered several suspects from the conspiracy in her house, claiming to have Bolívar's tacit approval to do so. It's not entirely clear why she did this, but perhaps this is yet another example of Bolívar aping Julius Caesar. He had many of his enemies killed, but he was also famed for his clemency. If his opponents recanted and proclaimed their loyalty, he would often let them live. Despite his enemies' claims to the contrary, Bolívar was not an all-powerful dictator. His position at the top was fragile and depended on the loyalty and cooperation of others. He could not rule entirely by fear. And so, by stamping down on the rebellion while offering an olive branch to a select few, he was attempting to ensure he dealt with his most intransigent foes, without creating more enemies that may spout from the metaphorical hydra. And time was of the essence here, as the liberator's health was declining fast. Bolívar had long suffered from a variety of maladies, including recurring headaches, wasting, hemorrhoids, and chronic episodes of unconsciousness. This was not helped by the primary treatment prescribed to him, which was arsenic. It's also possible that he had tuberculosis, though this has been disputed by some modern scholars. Whatever the root cause of his sickness, it was becoming abundantly clear that he did not have long for this earth, and so serious and urgent thought had to be given to the succession. He had no children, no obvious member of his family who, armed with the legitimacy imparted by the Bolívar name, could take up his mantle. So the solution offered by, for example, Oliver Cromwell, who had passed power over the Commonwealth of England, Scotland and Ireland to his son on his death, was not open to him. Another option would be the one provided by Bolívar's fellow revolutionary republic to the north, an election. After 2 terms in office, George Washington had declined to seek a third and retired, with the presidency passing following an election under limited male suffrage to his revolutionary partner and former vice president, John Adams. Now, we've already talked about Bolívar's antipathy towards elections, so that wasn't ever going to be his preferred course. But the choice of one of his revolutionary colleagues seemed to be the most likely option. Of course, it wouldn't be his vice president. Santander's involvement in the Septembrian conspiracy ruled him out. And most of his other generals and partners in his revolutionary escapades were unconvinced by his grand designs on amalgamating the diverse nations of South America into a giant superstate. They didn't want to be part of Gran Colombia. They wanted to be Venezuelans, Bolivians, Colombians, or Ecuadorians. An example of this was the Venezuelan patriot and warlord José Antonio Páez, who, after helping Bolívar liberate his homeland from the Spanish, had remained behind while the Liberator went off on his great quest. He was not keen to be part of Gran Colombia. He wanted to be part of, and most likely rule, a free and independent Venezuela. He had already risen in rebellion once against Bolivar, and many other nationalist leaders across the Bolivarian Empire were minded to follow both his example and that of the Peruvians, who had already done the same. So if those options were not open to him, then only one seemed to remain – monarchy. For many people in South America, particularly in the revolutionary community, this was a dirty word bordering on the blasphemous. It conjured ideas of subjugation, a return to a dark past. Republics were fresh and in vogue. Kings and queens were a relic of the old world. Now, of course, monarchies come in many shapes and sizes. And indeed, its proponents in Gran Colombia were not thinking of an absolutist monarch like Louis XIV. They were looking to the British model of limited constitutional monarchy. As I said before, they already had a president for life. How big a step was it really to go the next step and give a clear and secure succession that monarchy can bring? Monarchs can be unifying figures, standing above the grubby and petty business of politics. Only a king could keep the fracturing Bolivarian creation of Gran Colombia together. But there was a problem. Well, actually, they were legion. But one of the major drawbacks is that this did not solve the principal issue at stake, which was the succession. As I said, Bolivar had no children, no obvious family to whom he could pass the throne should he be crowned as king. It is incredibly difficult to create a monarchy, because its legitimacy is drawn from its august lineage. The British monarchy dates back to the 9th century, the Spanish to the 8th, the French to the 6th century, though by now it had already had a couple of republican and imperial interruptions. Monarchies claim to derive their power from divine providence, through a bloodline blessed by God's grace. It's hard to claim that if you've just rocked up and declared yourself king. So if you can't create a king from the New World, you have to import one from the old. Obviously, Spain was out of the question. George III's children were so bad at having children that Britain couldn't spare one of its royals. But the newly restored French monarchy, well, that was a real option. This became Manuela Sainz's great project, to help guide Gran Colombia's transition from republic to monarchy, possibly with Bolívar as king, and then under an imported French successor. She could help realise her love's great dream, and maybe even gain a crown in the process. She was also an ardent Francophile. Having a dull and clingy English ex-husband will do that for you. It's not hard to see why she was on board. She teamed up with Bolívar's Minister of War, General Rafael Urdaneta, and together they began a great charm offensive. She hosted an official delegation that King Charles X of France sent to discuss the plan. This was a grand soiree attended by the entire diplomatic corps, barring the Americans, who abhorred this scandalous plan. She also strengthened ties with Bolívar's most influential supporters, including wealthy businessmen and, increasingly, the clergy. For example, in 1829, she joined the Confradia of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph of the Rock. This was a lay fraternity, and membership required her to pay an annual membership, visit the sick, and engage in various good works, as well as observe various holy days. Sainz was not an especially pious woman. Being locked away in a convent will do that to you. But these efforts were all about portraying her and Bolívar as defenders of the church and the Catholic faith. With the Spanish gone, the traditional conservatives needed someone new to support. Why not Bolívar? This earned her many admirers. One wrote to her, quote, Allow me, dear lady, to congratulate you on this day for the great part you played in preserving such an important life, a life of interest to all the American continent. Destiny has shown you, madame, that you are to serve as Bolivar's guardian angel. But while science was a bundle of energy, Bolivar's decline was gathering speed. When he returned to Bogota in January 1830, after putting down a rebellion incited by anger at his attempts to make himself king, a friend observed that he had grown, quote, pale and emaciated. The spark was fading. He could see that his work was not yet done, his dream not entirely realised, but he did not have the time or the energy to finish the job. And all around him, his world was crumbling. Separatist movements in Venezuela, Ecuador, and even Colombia, led by friends and former revolutionary comrades, were gathering strength, revitalized by fears over Bolivar's monarchical aspirations. He did not have the strength to continue raging against the dying of the light. His dream was slipping away like loose sand through his fingers. And by March 1830, he had had enough. He announced to the Congress of Gran Colombia that he was resigning from the presidency and retiring from public life. After getting his affairs in order, he left Bogota and travelled to Cartagena, where he planned to board a ship that would take him across the Atlantic and into exile.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.